Mossad operatives in Paris, placing them under surveillance, breaking into their meetings, identifying and burning their sources. A judicial inquiry into the murder remains open in France. Killing Bisseso, in fact, served as little more than a distraction at a critical time. Israel, already pilloried internationally, needed all the allies it could get. On the other hand, there's no doubt that eliminating a senior figure in the PLO who was in charge of Arafat's contacts with Western intelligence agencies did have an effect. The targeted killing, along with other operations based on intelligence supplied by Yassin, badly weakened the PLO during this period. In mid-1990, the Mossad and Amman's special operations executive hacked into the computer network of Al-Samit al-Iqtisadi, Fatah's financial arm, and transferred money from one account to another inside it, in a manner that made members think their colleagues were stealing the organization's funds, thereby sowing mistrust and confusion. Headquarters was in disarray, preoccupied with finding traitors and moles. The result was a significant reduction in the organization's attacks against Israel. The biggest blow, however, was a strategic blunder made by Arafat himself, without the help of the Mossad. In August 1990, Saddam Hussein sent 90,000 Iraqi soldiers and 700 tanks rolling over the border into tiny, oil-rich Kuwait. The invasion was almost universally condemned by both the West and most of the Middle East, and eventually was repelled by a massive, multinational, American-led force. Arafat and Libya's Muammar Gaddafi were the only Arab leaders who backed Saddam, and they refused to join an Arab League resolution calling on him to pull his forces out of Kuwait. Arafat likened the American-led coalition, which included many Arab states, to a new crusade, and declared that Saddam was the defender of the Arab nation, of Muslims, and of free men everywhere. This infuriated the surrounding Gulf states, upon whose cash the PLO, with its now insatiable pit of corruption, relied. By mid-1992, the organization was broke. The PLO, for years Israel's nemesis, finally had been pushed to the wall. At the same time, the Intifada was still fully aflame, a struggle that was increasingly wearying the Israeli public. The IDF deployed tens of thousands of troops in the occupied territories. In total, throughout the uprising, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, most of them 18 to 22-year-old conscripts, were charged with policing the Palestinian population. Instead of fighting to defend the country's borders, the putative central mission of the Israeli army, they were assigned to duties like suppressing demonstrations, searching men and women at roadblocks, and chasing down kids who'd thrown rocks at them, all part of the Sisyphean task of suppressing the Palestinian uprising against the occupation. When these young soldiers came home on short furloughs, they brought with them a sense of the hopelessness of the job, and the political debate in family living rooms and workplaces between worried parents and siblings revolved around the question, why are we there at all? Over 4 years, the Intifada morphed from an isolated disturbance on the nightly news into a seemingly endless crisis that affected hundreds of thousands of Israeli families. Adding to the growing unease about the situation in the occupied territories was the anxiety and anger injected by a series of stabbing attacks by Palestinians inside the Green Line borders of Israel proper. The most significant of these was the murder of a young girl by the name of Helena Rapp in the Tel Aviv suburb of Bat Yam in May 1992. It led to stormy protests against the government and to a feeling that Shamir was incapable of ensuring the safety of the citizenry. At the same time, Shamir became embroiled in an angry confrontation with the American administration over the continued construction in the occupied territories, and President George H.W. Bush refused to approve financial benefits sorely needed by Israel for the absorption of 1 million Jewish immigrants pouring in from the disintegrating Soviet Union. The Intifada and the severe financial crisis eventually brought down the Shamir government. On June 23, 1992, Yitzhak Rabin, who was perceived by the electorate as a pillar of security, but also someone who would make genuine efforts to achieve peace with the Palestinians, was elected prime minister by a significant majority, a win by the center-left more decisive than any Israel has seen since. Rabin, who had served as defense minister during the Intifada, was himself deeply affected by the conflict with the Palestinians, and had reached the conclusion that a compromise must be reached. Hobbled by Israeli intelligence operations and reeling from his Iraqi debacle, Yasser Arafat once again resorted to his tried and tested survival technique. Palestinian historian Yazid Saig described it as Hurub ila al-Amam, running away by running forward. Backing an illegal invasion had made him a pariah, even among his wealthy Arab sponsors. On the other hand, even if he hadn't initiated and couldn't control the Intifada, he was still perceived as the Palestinian leader, the one man who might be able to negotiate a peace. It was Arafat's gift to exploit the latter crisis to cover up, run away from, the former crisis. Arafat permitted his people to open a secret back channel with a group of Israeli academics, first in London and later in Oslo. Initially, the Israeli professors acted on their own, but later they brought in Deputy Foreign Minister Yossi Beilin, who reported directly to Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. When Peres informed Rabin about the contact with the Palestinians, the premier instructed him to drop it immediately, but shortly afterward he changed his mind and decided to give the initiative a chance. The negotiations, however, were kept secret, even from the heads of Israel's military and intelligence organizations. Rabin instructed Unit 8200, which eavesdropped on Palestinian communications, to report anything they heard about the discussion directly and solely to him. Officially, this was for operational security. Any leak that got out to the various Palestinian factions could derail the talks. Unofficially, Rabin wasn't entirely certain that men who'd spent years trying to kill Arafat and his minions, who ran agencies that had invested enormous effort in the war on Palestinian terrorism, could make the mental adjustment necessary to see a former enemy as a partner in peace. Rabin knew that any diplomatic process with the PLO could end in agreement only if it included territorial concessions. A large segment of the Israeli population, however, was bitterly opposed to any such compromise, for ideological and religious reasons. Any leak disclosing that secret negotiations were underway, emanating, say, from sources inside the defense or intelligence communities who thought that it was a strategic error, would have revealed the possibility of territorial concessions and thereby killed the negotiation instantly. This exclusion of the military and intelligence from the negotiation process created an odd situation, however. While the highest levels of the Israeli government were trying to negotiate peace, the country's intelligence agencies continued fighting a covert war, unaware that anything had changed. The Mossad had invested heavily in Adnan Yassin and Operation Golden Fleece, and it was still paying dividends. In the spring of 1993, more than 4 years after Yassin had first been targeted as an asset, he told his case officer of a conversation he'd had with Amina, the wife of Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the PLO's second-in-command, who was also in charge of the organization's diplomatic activities. Her husband was badly overweight, she told him, and suffering from severe back pains. She knew Yassin could get hold of almost anything, and she thought an orthopedic chair from Europe might help Abbas. Of course, Yassin told her, asking if she needed anything else for the office. She requested an especially bright lamp, as Abu Mazen's eyesight was weakening. Yassin promised to do what he could. The Mossad jumped at the opportunity and supplied Yassin with a luxurious leather office chair and a decorative table lamp, both fitted with microphones and transmitters. Yassin brought the new items to Abbas's office, even taking the trouble to move the old chair himself, cursing whoever gave such miserable furniture to such important people. He put the new chair in place, then put the lamp on the desk, plugged it in, and switched it on. The lamp was the more important of the two pieces of furniture, because while the bugs planted in the chair required batteries that would have to be replaced, the lamp could serve as a transmitter for years, powered by a constant supply of electricity direct from the grid. The chair contained two separate energy-saving devices, spring switches that turned the microphones on only when someone was putting weight on them, and a voice activation system, which meant that if someone was sitting on the chair but not talking to anyone, the batteries still would not get used up. Transmissions from the chair were picked up and relayed to Tel Aviv from the very first day it was placed in Abbas's office. Mossad Director Shavit realized what an achievement this was. Abu Mazen was at the hub of the PLO's activities, and innumerable people passed through his office, sharing the organization's most important secrets with him. Yet, very quickly, another matter emerged, one much more unexpected. The director of the Mossad learned from the singing chair, as it was known, that the Israeli government was conducting advanced negotiations with the PLO behind his back. Rabin had ordered Amman's SIGINT Unit 8200 to bring anything they heard about the negotiations directly to him, but he had not done the same with the Mossad. Shavit angrily confronted Rabin, complaining about the Mossad being left out of the loop. Rabin placated Shavit by saying that it was a marginal initiative by Peres, to which he, Rabin, did not ascribe any significance. Then, as abruptly as they'd begun, the transmissions stopped. 3.5 weeks after the concealed microphones had been planted, the giant antennas at Mossad headquarters quit picking up signals. At first, the Israelis thought there might be a technical problem, but an inspection showed that all the links between the Mossad and Abbas's office were in good working order, and anyway, it was highly unlikely that both would malfunction at the exact same time. This almost certainly meant that both microphones had been discovered, that Operation Golden Fleece had been blown, and that their prize asset, Adnan Yassin, was in mortal peril. "We couldn't understand," a source in the Mossad's counterterrorism division said, "how it was possible, how it could be, that so short a time after we managed to put the equipment in place, it was discovered, together with the agent who did it." It was Jibril Rajoub who detected the presence of the equipment, with the assistance of the local intelligence agency. Rajoub said, "Our people in Oslo sensed that the Israelis were seeing through them, that they knew exactly what they were going to say next, and what positions to take. This aroused the suspicion of eavesdropping, and that's why we went to scan Abu Mazen's office." However, most Mossad operatives involved in Golden Fleece had a very different explanation. Their own people had betrayed them. According to this theory, which is unprovable but is supported by some serious circumstantial evidence, one of the Israeli negotiators in Oslo saw the reports on the intelligence gathered during the operation and distributed to the Prime Minister and the heads of the intelligence community. He grasped that the source of the intelligence was some kind of eavesdropping device in Abu Mazen's office or a tap on one of his communication lines. He then tipped the Palestinians off, knowing that they would immediately locate the devices and dismantle them. Once that happened, Israeli intelligence would have no way of knowing what was happening at the talks, which would mean none of the hardliners could leak the details to the media and ruin the negotiations. In other words, an Israeli diplomat betrayed Israeli intelligence to prevent Israeli intelligence from sabotaging Israeli diplomacy. The fact that a valuable asset would likely be killed was beside the point. Yassin was arrested and tortured until he confessed everything: how he'd been recruited, the information he'd provided, how his greed had turned him against his own people. Arafat, stunned that such a trusted aide had been arrested, went to see Yassin in his cell at the Fatah interrogation facility to hear the story for himself. It was a foregone conclusion that Yassin would be executed. He was undeniably a traitor, and he'd been deeply involved in the killing of Beseso. Soon after, in Oslo, The Palestinian delegate fumed about the Yassin arrest and the Bezeso killing. He asked one of the Israelis what he knew. "I know nothing about this story," said the Israeli, who truly was not party to any intelligence secrets, but understood what had happened from the little he had heard from Perez and Balin. "But let's all drink to that being the last assassination." He added one last word in Arabic. "Inshallah. God willing." The delegates around the table, four Palestinians, three Israeli Jews, and two Norwegians, all lifted their glasses. The atmosphere was optimistic. The negotiations had lasted 6 months so far and had generated historic letters of mutual recognition between the two nations, from Rabin to Arafat and from Arafat to Rabin. These letters would evolve into a series of agreements that became known as the Oslo Accords. At the first stage, the Accords begat the Autonomous Palestinian Authority, PA, which was to rule over most of the territory populated by Palestinians. The Palestinians undertook to stop the Intifada and to renounce terrorism. The bloody conflict in the Middle East seemed as if it might finally come to a peaceful end. Yasser Arafat and most of the PLO and Fatah leaders left Tunis and took up residence in the autonomous occupied PA territories. Even Adnan Yassin appeared to benefit from the newfound cooperation. The Oslo Accords engendered security coordination committees with delegates from the military and intelligence apparatuses of both sides. For the first time, top Mossad and Shin Bet officials were meeting with men who, a few short months earlier, had been their targets for either espionage or assassination. The meetings were held in the Palestinian territories or in hotels in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. The two sides overcame their initial suspicions through lighthearted mutual teasing about the past. Who had succeeded in tricking whom? Whether the Palestinians had conducted operations the Israelis didn't know about? Where and when the Israelis had foiled Palestinian plans? The Israelis took advantage of this genial atmosphere to request clemency for Yassin. "We raised it as a plea for a goodwill gesture in return for the thousands of Palestinian prisoners that Israel had undertaken to release as part of the deal," said one of the Mossad participants in the committee meetings. The pressure and the atmosphere worked. In the end, Yassin was not executed, but only sentenced to 15 years in prison. It was a lenient sentence, all things considered. In the summer of 1993, it seemed Yassin would live to see a lasting peace in the Middle East. Inshallah. Chapter 20. Nebuchadnezzar. On the night of April 6, 1979, outside a shipping hangar on the waterfront, a pair of headlights poked through the darkness, casting two cones of yellow-white on the pavement, widening as the car came closer. It was a Fiat 127 sedan, the engine sputtering and clanking, and stalling 200 yards from the front gate. The two French guards outside the hangar, at La Seine-sur-Mer, just west of Toulon on France's Mediterranean coast, eyed the car warily. The hangar belonged to the CNIM group, which specialized in manufacturing large-scale, complex components for ships and nuclear reactors. There were always two guards on duty, three shifts a day, 8 hours each, all of them boring. The guards took a few steps toward the fence as the doors opened. Two women got out. Pretty girls, the guards thought. But the women seemed confused, almost angry, as they tottered toward the gate. "Pouvez-vous nous aider?" one of them asked from the other side of the fence. "Can you help us?" They were British tourists, she said, out for a night on the Riviera, but their lousy car kept breaking down. She smiled. A flirt. Maybe later, she said, the guards could join them at one of the bars. The guards gathered some tools, opened the gate, walked toward the car. They were smiling. Behind them, five bayonet operatives hustled over the fence, quickly and noiselessly, a maneuver they'd practiced endlessly at a military base on Israel's southern coast. Just as quietly, they forced their way into the hangar, Inside, they attached 5 powerful explosives to 2 enormous cylinders. They set timers on the detonators, then slipped back out, over the fence, and into the night. They'd needed less than 5 minutes to get in and out. On the street in front of the hangar, the guards managed to get the car started. It had been surprisingly easy. Then the women, both Israeli operatives, promised to meet them later and drove off. At the same time, some distance away, a man and a woman holding hands walked along slowly. They seemed preoccupied with their romance. The man, his hair slicked back, looked a little like Humphrey Bogart. He peered over the woman's shoulder and saw the car starting up and driving off. The couple turned around, and a few streets away, they got into a car and also drove off. They were Mike Harari, Kasareya's boss, and Tamara, a female Mossad operative. 30 minutes later, the hangar exploded. Flames ripped into the night sky and lit up the waterfront in orange and red. Firefighters extinguished the blaze before the building was completely destroyed, but everything inside was badly damaged, including some carefully crafted machines that it had taken more than 2 years to manufacture. Fully assembled with the rest of the components, they would make a 70-megawatt nuclear reactor, large enough that it was known as an Osiris-class reactor. Osiris is the ancient Egyptian god of the afterlife, the underworld, and the dead. The French were selling it to Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi dictator, who saw himself as the modern embodiment of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king who destroyed the kingdom of Israel. A few hours after the bombing, a spokesman for Groupe des Ecologistes Français telephoned a newspaper to claim responsibility. But no one, certainly not French intelligence, believed him. Everyone assumed that it was the Israelis, because they had the most pressing motive. While many of Israel's defense and intelligence assets were bogged down in the bloody muck of Lebanon, existential threats to the tiny nation continued to haunt the Mossad. Chief among them was Iraq, a country ruled by an unhinged butcher with a long-standing ambition to become the next Saladin. One of the IDF's nightmare scenarios was a massive Iraqi army joining up with the Jordanians to create a menacing Eastern Front. Israeli forces had been covertly involved in Iraq since the 1960s, when the oppressed Kurdish minority rebelled against the Baghdad regime. The country supplied arms to the Kurds, and IDF soldiers and Mossad personnel trained fighters in commando warfare. The idea, according to Meir Amit, who ran the Mossad then, was to create a Middle East in which we would be able to act against our enemies on several fronts simultaneously. To put it more simply, Iraq was a declared enemy of Israel, and the Kurds were an enemy of Baghdad. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. At the same time, such alliances, for example, with the Shah of Iran and the Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, two states that bordered Israel's hostile Arab neighbors, allowed the Mossad to establish listening posts and other intelligence assets inside otherwise unfriendly countries. Starting in 1969, Israeli advisors, among them explosives expert Natan Rothberg, began hearing about the man the Kurds called the Butcher of Baghdad. Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti had been part of the Ba'athist coup that had taken power the year before, and he was appointed vice chairman of Iraq's Revolutionary Council, second in command of the new regime and in charge of the armed forces and intelligence services. He ordered bombs dropped on civilians, choked off food supplies to starve dissident populations, and set up a network of torture chambers in which he often did the torturing himself. The Kurds asked the Israelis to help them kill Saddam. Rothberg even prepared a booby-trapped Quran for the task, the same tactic he had used to assassinate the chief of Egyptian intelligence in 1956. But PM Golda Meir refused to sign the red page. She feared that the Kurds would not keep Israel's involvement a secret, and that her government would get embroiled in an international scandal with the Russians and the Americans, both of whom were wooing Saddam assiduously at that time. Earlier, Meir had also dismissed the notion of assassinating Egypt's Nasser, for fear that killing him would legitimize attempts on her life and those of her ministers. Left alive, Saddam, as ruthless as he was ambitious, took over the Ba'ath Party and thus Iraq. By 1971, when he was 34 years old, Saddam had removed all of his serious rivals in the regime and had assumed power in all but name, leaving the president, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr, as nothing more than a figurehead. He would finally push out al-Bakr completely in 1979. He saw himself as a historic figure, a pan-Arab leader who would make Iraq a regional power, the leading force in the Arab world and the equal of Iran. Saddam thought that Jews were a mixture of the garbage and leftovers of various nations, and he wanted to redraw the whole of the Middle East, erasing Israel entirely. The Iraqis made no secret of this. The existence of an artificial Zionist entity symbolizes the negation of the Arabs' historical right to existence and is a slight to their honor, the Ba'ath Party newspaper Al-Jamriya wrote in March 1974. This bellicose entity is nothing but a terrible cancer that dangerously spreads beyond its borders. We must fight Zionism in every possible way. Arab Jerusalem awaits the Arab Salah al-Din, Saladin, who will redeem it from the pollution with which Zionism has stained our holy places. The clear implication was that Saddam Hussein would be the modern version of Saladin and drive the infidels out of Palestine. But Saddam realized that Iraq would never be a credible power without a formidable arsenal. The only way to conquer the Middle East was to have the ability to destroy it. Saddam wanted nuclear weapons. In 1973, the dictator brought Iraq's nuclear program, ostensibly a peaceful civilian enterprise, under his direct control, and began investing budgets of billions, practically unlimited, in the words of Ahmad Zia Baram, a prominent biographer of Saddam, into developing reactors that eventually could produce an atomic arsenal. Ideally, a dictator already known for bombing his own people, and hell-bent on becoming a nuclear menace, would be shunned by civilized nations. But geopolitics is a complicated business. Several Western powers, including the United States but most notably France, wanted to exert their own influence in the Middle East. And what's not complicated is merely crass. Saddam was throwing around a lot of money. France and Israel had a long and complicated history that was reaching its low point in the 1970s. The relationship had been rife with hostility and distrust ever since de Gaulle had turned on the Jewish nation in the 60s. To the French, the possibility that Iraq represented a mortal threat to the nation of Israel seemed, at most, a manageable concern. President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing and his Prime Minister Jacques Chirac orchestrated a number of deals with Iraq in the first half of the 70s. The most significant was the sale of two nuclear reactors, one very small 100-kilowatt reactor, designated ISIS class, and a larger 40-megawatt OSIRIS reactor, which was expandable to 70 megawatts. The Iraqis combined the name of the reactor with the name of their country, calling it OSIRAK. Although Iraq's stated intention was to use the reactor for research purposes, the French knew that a reactor of that size would almost certainly end up being used to process fuel for nuclear weapons. The reactor's core held 12 kilograms of 93% enriched uranium, enough to make an atom bomb. So if the French kept their promise to replace spent fuel rods, the Iraqis would be able to simply convert some of them into material for use in nuclear arms. The Iraqis admitted as much. The search for technology with military potential is a response to Israel's nuclear armament, Saddam declared in an interview on September 8, 1975, just before he visited Paris to sign more deals. The Franco-Iraqi agreement is the first Arab step toward gaining nuclear arms, even if our declared goal in building the reactor is not the manufacture of atom bombs. But it takes years and very specific expertise to build atom bombs. Any legitimate threat, the French seemed to assume, could be dealt with when and if it arose. The Iraqis paid very generously. Some 7 billion francs, $2 billion at the time, were transferred directly to France. The French also received favorable terms and a price reduction on their import of Iraqi oil. A number of French companies were connected to the vast project, and joint management was set up to run things in Paris and Baghdad. Not far from the construction site, luxurious living quarters were constructed for 2,000 French engineers and technicians. Israel could not stand idly by. A joint Mossad-Amman foreign ministry team, dubbed New Era, was set up to make a special, concentrated effort to zero in on Iraq's intention to obtain nuclear weapons, in the words of Nahum Admoni, then the deputy director of the Mossad who headed the team. Under the guise of European businessmen or NATO European military officers, junction case officers approached Iraqis working in France who they believed might potentially become informants. One scientist, whose son had cancer and was receiving inferior treatment in Iraq, traded secrets for better medical care. He believed that Yehuda Gil, Israel's top recruiter, was the deputy CEO of a European firm concerned with nuclear safety. But that was a one-time success. Saddam had frightened all those involved in the project into silence with a video of Iraqi cabinet ministers executing other officials. "It was a terrifying tape," said Khidir Hamza, one of the directors of Iraq's nuclear program. "He was sending a message that if he's unhappy with you for any reason, you are dead." Still, the Israelis had other sources. French scientists, technicians, secretaries, and mid-level managers. Some were paid handsomely. Others, Jews, did so for ideological reasons. Through one of these sources, the Mossad obtained the Project Book, a document detailing all the deals signed with Iraq. Several hundred pages long, it had been written in English by the French scientists. "From that book," says Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Raphael Ofek, a nuclear physicist at Ben-Gurion University recruited by Amman, "we learned a lot, including the layout of the project site where the reactor and adjoining laboratories were situated at Tuwaitha Nuclear Research Center." Unit 8200, Amman's SIGINT arm, established a top-secret task force nicknamed Apocalypse, that tapped into telephone and telex lines, and Rainbow agents planted bugs in the Iraqis' Paris offices. With reams of damning intelligence, Israel called on the international community to halt the program. But exasperated foreign leaders, critics of Israel, and even some domestic opponents of Begin charged Israel with alarmism. "The Iraqi project could not possibly harm Israel," they insisted. The French continued to maintain that the project was an entirely legitimate research program, and that they were using enough security mechanisms to ensure that Iraq would not be able to develop nuclear bombs. Foreign Minister Moshe Dayan, who returned from a visit to Paris appalled at the French indifference to his requests, tried the Americans next, asking Washington to pressure the French, also to no avail. Israel concluded that the diplomatic path had failed. In November 1978, the Security Cabinet authorized the Prime Minister to take necessary actions to halt the Iraqi nuclear project. The Mossad was given the green light to act. Osiris, the cabinet concluded, must be killed. Not long after came the explosion at the shipping hangar on the French Riviera. The components the operative blew up that night were badly damaged, and the Israelis believed they'd set back Saddam's nuclear ambitions by at least 2 years, the amount of time it would take the French to manufacture new components. But the Iraqi dictator would not allow such a delay. He ordered the project to proceed on schedule. Iraq's Minister of Defense demanded that the French repair the parts and deliver them on time. The French countered that a repaired casing would not be as strong. It would be risky to use, and would almost certainly have to be replaced in just a few years. But no one dared cross Saddam Hussein. Iraq could still have nuclear weapons within a few years. Frustrated Mossad officials decided that they needed to begin using more aggressive tactics. They would start killing scientists. The most obvious targets for elimination were the heads of the Iraqi program, Khidir Hamza and Jafar Diyar-Jafar. The latter was the brains of the project, the most important scientist, according to Dr. Ofek. He was a graduate of Birmingham University, held a PhD in physics from Manchester University, and had worked as a researcher at the Center for Nuclear Engineering of Imperial College in London. But both men rarely left Iraq, where successfully killing either one would be extremely difficult, if not impossible. Yet just as Nasser had hired Germans to build his missiles, Iraq had recruited Egyptians to help develop its nuclear program. The most important among them was Yahya al-Mashad, a nuclear physics prodigy at Alexandria University, who became a senior scientist at the Nuclear Research Center at Al-Tuwaita in Iraq. Mashad traveled frequently between Egypt, Iraq, and France. The Mossad began to track his moves in February 1980 and shadowed him constantly whenever he was in Paris or at the French Institute for Radiological Protection and Nuclear Safety at Fontenay-aux-Roses near the capital. In early June, the French prepared a shipment of uranium for the Iraqis to use in their ISIS small reactor. Mashad came to France to check the quality. He traveled with two aides who never left his side, making him difficult to reach. The Mossad's plan, then, was to poison Mashad via some common and innocuous item, similar to the way Wadi Haddad had been killed with tainted toothpaste in 1978. But at the last minute, Mashad decided to cut short his stay in France. He wanted to visit his family in Egypt. That meant the Mossad operatives didn't have enough time to implement their original plan. But Mashad also decided to spend his last night in Paris alone. He let his two Iraqi assistants go, because the hotel he was in was very expensive, Hamza said. He was a kind man. He told them, okay, you might want to stay in a more convenient shopping neighborhood and a cheaper hotel that would be more accessible to you. So you can go ahead. With no aides to protect him, Mashad suddenly became a much more vulnerable target. He returned to his hotel at about 6 o'clock in the evening of June 13. He showered and changed, had a drink and a sandwich in the lobby, then went back to his room on the ninth floor. Carlos, the commander of bayonet and another operative, hid in a recess in the corridor, watching the door. The plan had changed so rapidly, they weren't sure what to do. Carlos had a pistol, but the standing orders were that guns could not be used in hotels under any circumstances, since bullets can go through walls and hit innocents. Carlos was adapting on the fly. The elevator opened at about 9:30. A young woman got out, a prostitute. She walked by the two bayonet men but ignored them. She knocked on the door of 9041. Mashad let her in. Carlos and his partner waited for 4 hours, until the prostitute finally left at 1:30 a.m. By then, Carlos had found an ashtray with a stand near the elevator, a yard tall, with a heavy base, a narrow leg, and a plunger mechanism at its top end for disposing of accumulating cigarette butts. He examined it carefully, weighed it in his hands, felt its heft. He decided it was solid enough to use. Take out your blade, Carlos told the other operative, who was armed with a large Leatherman pocket knife. The two men approached Mashad's door, and the companion knocked.
Kayla,
Mashad said. Who's there? He sounded sleepy, relaxed. Hotel security, Carlos told him. It's about your recent guest. Mashad shuffled across his room and opened the door. Carlos brought the ashtray down hard on his head. Mashad lurched backward and crumpled to the floor. Carlos lunged after him, hit him again, and then once more. Blood formed a spreading stain on the carpet. There was no need for the knife. The two operatives washed the blood off their arms and rinsed off the ashtray. Carlos removed his blood-stained shirt, crumpled it up, and shoved it into his pocket. As they left, they made sure the Do Not Disturb sign dangled on the doorknob. They put the ashtray back where it belonged, took the elevator down to the lobby, and sauntered out of the hotel. Hotel security found Mashed's body 15 hours later. Police at first thought he'd been battered in the sex game gone wrong, but they found the prostitute and quickly cleared her. Mashed hadn't been robbed, and he'd had no other visitors. But the prostitute remembered seeing two men in the hallway. The French figured out pretty quickly that the Mossad had killed Mashed. So did the Iraqis. I thought we were all targeted, Hamza said. After that, I would travel only with an Iraqi intelligence officer with me. Saddam Hussein understood that the targeted killings could devastate morale among the scientists working on his nuclear project. He handed out luxury cars and cash bonuses to all the senior scientists and paid Mashad's wife compensation of $300,000, an enormous sum at the time in Egypt, and promised her and Mashad's children a lifelong monthly pension. It did nothing, however, to stop the killings. 3 weeks after Mashed was killed, a British-educated Iraqi engineer named Salman Rashid was sent to Geneva for 2 months of training in the enrichment of uranium by means of electromagnetic isotope separation. He had a bodyguard who never left his side. A week before he was to return to Iraq, Rashid became violently ill. Doctors in Geneva suspected a virus. 6 days later, on September 14, Rashid died in agony. An autopsy showed that there had been no virus. The Mossad had poisoned him, though how and with what toxin, no one could say for certain. 2 weeks later, another senior Iraqi engineer, Abd al-Rahman Rasul, a civil engineer who handled the construction of the various buildings for the nuclear project, took part in a conference sponsored by the French Atomic Energy Commission. Immediately after the cocktail party and official reception that opened the conference, he came down with what seemed to be food poisoning. He died 5 days later in a Paris hospital. In early August, many of the French participants in the Iraqi project received a letter containing a blunt warning that they would be in danger if they did not leave immediately. Saddam Hussein was furious. And a few days later he delivered a particularly angry speech against Israel, not mentioning the attacks against the scientists, but threatening to reduce Tel Aviv to rubble with bombs. Saddam's scientists began to panic. Nobody would want to travel, Hamza said, so we were given bonuses if we traveled. They also received training in personal security and self-defense. A Mukhabarat intelligence man would tell us how to eat, not to accept an invitation after dark, always be accompanied. We were trained to carry with us our toothpaste, our toothbrushes, our shaving equipment, either in a small bag or in our pocket. A few French contractors resigned in fear, and the Iraqi nuclear project was slowed down slightly. But Saddam had put the resources of an autocratic nation into building a bomb, and he could spare a technician or three in the process. All of the scientists, both the dead and the frightened, were quickly replaced. France sent 12 kilograms of enriched uranium and filled a second order shortly afterward. At best, Israel had bought some time before Saddam could complete the construction of the reactors and begin to activate them. Perhaps 18 months, perhaps 2 years. But Iraq still expected, and Israel still feared, that Saddam would have fully operational nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them by the end of the decade. Yitzhak Hofi, the Mossad director, knew that intelligence, targeted killings, and sabotage operations could do only so much. I give up, he told Begin in October 1980. We will not be able to stop it. The only way still open is bombing from the air. The only way left, in other words, was an outright act of war. There was disagreement at the top in Israel. Some of the country's leading intelligence officials warned that bombing the Iraqi reactor would have dire international consequences, that it would take years before the reactor would produce enough fuel for a bomb, and that destroying it would push Saddam to take an alternate, more secretive approach, about which it would be far more difficult to gather information. There was so much tension that at one stage, Begin stopped inviting the head of his own Atomic Energy Commission, Uzi Elam, because he opposed the attack. One of Elam's staffers, Professor Uzi Evin, who feared that destroying the reactor would only lead to the transfer of the Iraqi nuclear project to secret installations, which Israel would not be able to keep under surveillance, leaked the plan for the anticipated attack to the head of the opposition, Shimon Peres. He, in turn, wrote a memo in his own handwriting to Begin, warning that if Israel went through with the attack, it would be isolated internationally, like a bramble in the wilderness, using the prophet Jeremiah's metaphor for how alone Israel would be if God abandoned it. But Prime Minister Begin, Ariel Sharon, who had recently been promoted to Minister of Defense, and IDF Chief of Staff Rafael Eitan rejected every argument against the mission. They subscribed to the opinion of Admoni and other top intelligence officials that the reactor should be attacked as soon as possible, before it became hot, in order to avoid the horrific humanitarian disaster that would take place in the event of a nuclear radiation leak. At the New Era Forum, the physicist and officer Dr. Ofek repeatedly insisted that in order to ensure the total destruction of the reactor, one objective had to be achieved. Enough explosives to wreck the internal pool in which the uranium rods were to be immersed. On June 7, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 8 F-16 planes took off from the Etzion base in Israeli-occupied Sinai to attack the Osirak reactor. They were escorted by 6 F-15s to provide cover, and another 60 aircraft were deployed to support the operation, some of which circled in the air while others remained at the ready on the ground. They included Boeings adapted for mid-air refueling and for airborne command and control, Hawkeye planes to provide intelligence, and helicopters in case a plane went down and a rescue operation was necessary. The F-15s could handle any Iraqi MiG that might challenge the Israeli planes, and they also carried advanced electronic warfare systems to jam the radar of anti-aircraft missile batteries on the ground. The route was 600 miles long, crossing northern Saudi Arabia and the south of Jordan. The pilots flew very low, less than 300 feet above the ground, in order to avoid Jordanian, Saudi, and Iraqi radar. The planes reached the target toward sundown at about 5:30 p.m. The 8 F-16s climbed to an altitude of 1,000 feet, executed a roll maneuver, and released their bombs at an angle of 35 degrees. One after the other, they dropped 2 1-ton bombs each on the concrete dome of the reactor. Half of the bombs were set to explode on contact, and the other half would go off only after they had burrowed deep into the structure. 7 of the 8 pilots hit the target, and 12 of the 16 bombs penetrated the dome. 10 Iraqi soldiers and 1 French technician were killed as well. The Iraqis were taken completely by surprise. Not one missile was fired at the attacking planes, and only sporadic, harmless anti-aircraft fire was aimed at them on their way back. All the planes made it safely home to base. To this day, they bear an image of the reactor on their nose, along with the circles that represent planes downed in combat. By midnight, the video footage taken by the airborne cameras had been analyzed, documenting the huge damage done to the reactor. At 3 a.m., Unit 8200's Apocalypse team intercepted a phone call made by one of the engineers describing an inspection of the bombed-out site in darkness. The engineer had looked for the pool, the critical part at the heart of the structure, but, with the help of his flashlight, he found only chunks of blasted concrete covered by the water, the sections of the dome that had collapsed inward. In the immediate intelligence survey that was distributed to the top government officials and heads of the intelligence community, Amman confirmed that the reactor pool had been irreparably damaged and that the reactor has been totally destroyed. Before the attack, the intelligence community had recommended that Israel not claim responsibility. They believed that without an embarrassing public humiliation, Saddam would not feel pressure to stage a counterattack on Israel. Would have room to maneuver. In the end, however, Begin decided otherwise. The bombing raid had been perfectly executed. Iraq's reactor left in smoldering ruins, and Saddam's nuclear ambitions perhaps permanently stalled. Begin wanted to acknowledge those facts, even to boast of them. He had a keen sense of the mood of the Israeli public. In a speech in the Knesset, he equated Saddam with Hitler, and the perils of a nuclear Iraq with the Nazis' final solution. "What could we have done against such a terrible danger?" he asked. "This country and its people would have been annihilated. Another Holocaust would have happened in the history of the Jewish people." Saddam delivered a speech of his own in private to the leadership of the Ba'ath Party. "It is painful," he admitted with a sigh, referring to the bombing, "because this is a dear fruit that we labored very hard to harvest, one of the fruits of the revolution and one for which we have exerted tremendous efforts politically, scientifically, economically, for a long period of time." But he quickly moved into his customary pugnacious tone, cursing the Zionist entity and Menachem Begin. Saddam then continued, "Begin and others have to realize that what they call preemptive strikes, which aim to prevent the advancement and rise of the Arab nation, and prevent it from using science and technology, will not prevent the Arab nation from moving toward its goals. And this method of preemptive strikes will not provide the Jews with the security of which he is speaking." 3 weeks later, Begin celebrated again, this time with a victory in the general election. The Mossad and the IDF were also triumphant over the success of the operation, and what they saw as the destruction of the Iraqi nuclear project. They relegated Iraq to the bottom of the list of intelligence priorities. But Saddam's reaction to the bombing of the reactor in Baghdad was precisely the opposite of what Israeli intelligence had expected. "Saddam, under pressure, becomes more aggressive and becomes more determined," said Dr. Hamza. "So the $400 million project became a $10 billion project, and the 400 scientists became 7,000. Saddam issued orders for a major effort to be invested in any and all scientific paths that could lead him in the shortest possible time to the acquisition of an atomic bomb and the means for delivering it to a target. Very quickly, he found Western companies that were ready to supply him, in exchange for vast sums of money, equipment and raw materials that, while ostensibly for civilian purposes, could also be applied to military ends for the development of nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons of mass destruction. Israel uncovered only small traces of these efforts. One plan it did uncover was the Condor Project, a joint Iraqi, Egyptian, and Argentinian effort to develop missiles of various types. A large amount of information about the project was obtained and conveyed to Israel by Mossad agents in the German companies involved in the project and in Argentina's scientific world, as well as by Jonathan Pollard, the spy working for Israel deep inside an American intelligence agency. The Mossad began torching the offices of the European companies involved and systematically terrorizing the scientists, in a manner similar to the way the German rocket scientists in Egypt had been intimidated in the 1960s. They received anonymous phone calls telling them, "If you don't desist immediately, we'll kill you and your family." The Mossad drew up plans to eliminate some of the scientists as well, but it turned out that the pressure, the arson, and the break-ins, as well as the Mossad's lethal reputation, obviated the need for targeted killings. The scientists departed, and Argentina and Egypt thinned out their financial participation. In his distress, Saddam turned to a Canadian rocket scientist, formerly employed by NASA, the United States Army, and Israel, named Gerald Bull, asking him to develop missiles and a supercannon, inspired by Jules Verne's science fiction novel, From the Earth to the Moon, that could send huge payloads enormous distances, as far as Tehran, 430 miles from Baghdad, and Tel Aviv, 570 miles from Baghdad. Bull assured his clients that his supercannon would not only have an immensely long range, but would also be a more accurate and effective way to fire biological and chemical agents, because the warheads would heat up less than the Scud missiles Iraq possessed. In 1989, Bull and the Iraqis erected the cannon at Jabal Hamrayan, 125 miles north of Baghdad. Three test firings were conducted. To his great misfortune, Bull never took seriously the threatening anonymous phone calls and letters he had received, which warned him that if he did not immediately terminate his relationship with Saddam, we will have to take harsh action against you, your companies, and the people involved with you. On March 22, 1990, a bayonet squad lay in wait for him at his home, a short drive away from his office in Brussels. Two men were hiding just behind the stairwell door. From their vantage point, they could see Bull walking toward his apartment, fumbling in his pockets for his keys. As soon as he passed and his back was to them, they leapt out from behind the door with their silenced Makarov pistols drawn. One of them fired two bullets into Bull's head and three into his back, while the other remained behind him, securing the area. Bull was dead before he hit the floor. The assassin whipped out a camera and took several pictures of the scientist's shattered head. One was a close-up, and another showed Bull lying on his belly in a huge pool of blood. The pictures were sent that day to the staff at Space Research Corporation, Bull's company. "If you go to work tomorrow," they wrote in an accompanying note, "you'll end up like this." No one turned up at the office the next day, and the company was soon terminated. The Mossad made sure that all of Bull's straw companies got the message as well. The project was dead in the water. On April 2, after Saddam learned from his intelligence services that Gerald Bull had been killed, he addressed his nation and vowed to make the fire eat up half of Israel. Indeed, the death of Bull only slowed down Saddam's effort to obtain long-range delivery tools and did not impede his nuclear project in any way. It turned out that the intelligence agencies of Israel and other Western nations were utterly ignorant of the major part of Saddam's military R&D efforts. This huge and very sophisticated network operated right under everyone's noses, said Brigadier General Shimon Shapira of Amman's research division. This was without a doubt one of the biggest failures in the history of Israeli intelligence. Israel, said Shapira, had more luck than sense. Saddam Hussein made a mistake by invading Kuwait in August 1990, assuming that the United States and the rest of the world would sit by, arms folded, in the face of his aggression. He was wrong. He brought upon himself a broad international coalition, one that included some Arab states, that kicked him out of Kuwait and forced him to accept stringent international inspection. UN inspectors then found what the Mossad had missed completely. By the time Operation Desert Storm to liberate Kuwait was launched, in January 1991, Saddam was only a few years away from full nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons capability, as well as the ability to manufacture missiles and warheads that could deliver those weapons to Israel. Even after the end of the war, when President Bush decided not to invade Iraq and to leave Saddam in place, IDF Chief of Staff Barak still believed that Saddam remained a clear and present danger to Israel. Saddam would certainly try again to develop weapons of mass destruction, and there was no possibility of entering into any sort of negotiation with him. On January 20, 1992, Barak ordered the formation of a team to examine the possibility of striking at the target, Saddam. 2 months later, on March 12, the team, headed by Amiram Levin, reported to the chief of staff on the plan's progress. Barak told the team, "The target is among the most important that has ever faced us in any pinpoint operation," and he ordered that preparations be made for execution of the plan in July of that year. Barak spoke to both Prime Minister Shamir and to Rabin, who replaced him in 1992, and tried to persuade them that the assassination weapon should be used for the first time against the leader of a sovereign state. In retrospect, Barak said years later, "Just imagine how we could have saved the world an entire decade with this terrible man. History would have looked different." The two premiers both gave him the go-ahead to plan the hit. Many ideas were put forward. Crashing an Israeli aircraft or even a satellite somewhere in Iraq, preferably in Baghdad. Waiting for Saddam to come and inspect the wreckage and then blowing it up with him and his entourage. Setting up a straw company in Europe that would sell Saddam a new and modern television studio from which to broadcast his speeches to the nation. Fitting it with equipment that would broadcast it to Israel and blowing it up while his face was on the screen. Switching a monument to one of his revolutionary comrades with a booby-trapped substitute, and detonating it as Saddam stood with his head bowed before it at a memorial ceremony, and many other schemes for disposing of the Iraqi dictator. In the end, it was decided to strike at Saddam at the only place outside of prohibitively well-guarded Baghdad where everyone could be sure that he himself, and not one of his doubles, would be. His family's plot in the cemetery at Tikrit, for the funeral of someone very close to him. That someone would be his uncle, Ker Ala Tulfakh, the man who had raised him, who was very ill. The Israelis closely followed the treatment Tulfakh was receiving in Jordan and waited for news of his death. But he kept clinging to life, so an alternative plan was decided upon. Instead of Tulfakh, the Mossad would eliminate Barzan al-Tikriti, the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations. Sayeret Matkal commandos would be flown to Tikrit in helicopters that would land some distance away, and then proceed to the cemetery in jeeps that looked exactly like the ones the Iraqi army used, but were in fact equipped with a special system that turned the roof of the car upside down and pulled out guided missiles. When Saddam came to attend the funeral, they would launch the missiles and kill him. If this plan succeeded, many of those involved believed, Chief of Staff Ehud Barak would go into politics and become a candidate with a good chance of becoming prime minister. This would be only natural for a man who was marked for greatness from the time he was a young lieutenant. At the huge Ze'elim training camp in Israel's Negev desert, Sayeret Matkal built a model of the Hussein family cemetery and practiced the operation. When they were ready, on November 5, 1992, the IDF's top brass came to watch a dress rehearsal. The hit team with the missiles took up positions, with members of the unit's intelligence and administrative staffs playing Saddam and his entourage. But because of serious planning flaws and weariness from the long training schedule, the men with the missiles mistook what was supposed to be a dry run, with a soldier posing as Saddam waving at the invisible crowds, for the wet run, in which the live soldier would be replaced by a mannequin. Things were so disorganized that the same code words, "send a cab," were used for both the dry and wet runs. The commander of the force, believing that this was the dry run, gave the order, "send a cab." But the commander of the firing chiefs thought that the wet run had begun. "Launch missile one," he ordered, and one of his men pushed the button and began guiding the missile toward the target. When approaching it, he noticed that something was wrong, and according to some witnesses, he yelled, "What's this? I don't understand why the dolls are moving." But it was too late. The missile landed right in the middle of the entourage. Seconds later, the second missile hit the ground a few yards away, but it did almost no damage because all of the men in the target area were already lying on the ground, dead or wounded. The commander realized that something had gone terribly wrong. "Cease fire," he yelled. "Cease fire. I repeat, cease fire." Five soldiers were killed, and all the others in the target area were wounded. Embarrassingly, the man playing Saddam was among the men who were only wounded. The incident became the cause of a fierce political storm and an ugly quarrel between Barak and some other generals over who was responsible. The accident at Ze'elim put an end to the plan to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Later, it turned out that, contrary to Barak's expectations, Saddam had not, in fact, resumed his attempts to obtain nuclear weapons after Operation Desert Storm. In any case, Israel by now was facing new enemies, much more dangerous ones. Chapter 21. Green Storm Rising. On March 13, 1978, a luxury executive jet took off on a